Imagine your heart is pounding. Your hands are shaking. You can't get your breath under control. What's going on? Like millions of Americans who suffer from anxiety disorders, you're having a panic attack. Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic magazine, has suffered since childhood from debilitating fears. He's abandoned flights, had breakdowns at job interviews, and frozen during public presentations. Scott Stossel is our guest this hour. He's traced anxiety's history and its treatment from Freud to pharmaceuticals and takes a look at anxiety in his own family. It's the most common mental disorder. Is it inherited? How do you come to terms with it? Scott Stossel on Fear, Hope, and the Search for Peace of Mind on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour. The National Institute for Mental Health estimates that 40 million Americans suffer from some type of anxiety disorder, a class that includes panic disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, phobias, and generalized anxiety disorder. Surveys by the World Health Organization rank anxiety disorders as the world's most common mental illness. Many people suffer secretly. Today, we get to hear from Scott Stossel. He's the editor of The Atlantic magazine and the author of the New York Times bestseller, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. It's published by Vintage and recently released in paperback. When Scott Stossel's book was first published in 2013, many of his colleagues were surprised to learn of his intense phobias, which included fear of public speaking, of flying, of heights, of closed spaces, of germs, fear of fainting. He suffered from anxiety since early childhood, worrying himself sick over school and pacing tracks in the carpet of his bedroom waiting for his parents to come home. Throughout the years, though, Scott Stossel learned to cope with his anxiety, coming to realize that illness is not a moral failing but an illness to be managed. Scott Stossel, I want to thank you for joining us here on WYPR on the Midday Show.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You know, when we talk about this today, talk about anxiety, is it important to make a difference between clinical anxiety and sort of, I don't know, normal anxiety, episodic anxiety, the anxiousness that people feel?
Yes, I think it is, but although that's not always such an easy distinction to make. Anxiety is a human trait that is woven into the human condition that has been with us ever since, you know, we descended from our primate ancestors. And, you know, the fear response, or, you know, in particular, the fight or flight response, is an evolutionarily adaptive response, which when it's deployed at the right moments, you know, if in the state of nature you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, attacked by an enemy tribe, it makes sense that, you know, all the blood would flow away from your digestive system into the large muscles in your arms and legs, and that your perception would change and you would sweat, because that prepares you to fight or to flee so you can, you know, enhance your chances of surviving. And so, again, that physiological response deployed appropriately is actually something that helps keep us alive. For people who have clinical anxiety, that fight or flight response, or you know, worrying about things, you know, becomes an incessant, relentless state of being, to the point where it interferes with your ability to go about daily life and to be a productive worker and to maintain relationships. And so, you know, almost everyone, you know, with the rare exceptions of, you know, exceptionally non-anxious people, some of whom are probably sociopaths, everybody deals with stress and anxiety, and, you know, anxiety in the right amount can be adaptive. But for people who are diagnosed with clinical anxiety disorders or, you know, pathological anxiety, the anxiety is so distressing and it interferes so much with their daily lives that, you know, it's rightfully classified as a disorder and the sort of thing that often requires treatment with either psychotherapy or medication or other forms of treatment.
And how long have professional clinicians been diagnosing anxiety? How long has it been around, so to speak?
Well, good question, and it depends on who you ask and how you answer the question, because in one sense, the more limited sense, the anxiety disorders per se have only been around since 1980, which is when the third edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is kind of the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association, came out. And that's when they basically legislated the anxiety disorders into existence. You mentioned them in the introduction, and that's panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, social phobia, specific phobia, used to be OCD. And before, you know, before that, those had been characterized as neuroses. So in some sense, the anxiety disorders, narrowly defined, have only been around since, you know, for 30 years. But anxiety, you know, however you define it, has been around since the dawn of human time. And, you know, in my research, I found instances of, you know, you go back to the ancient physician Hippocrates in the 4th century BC, and you read his case studies, and he's talking about people who have, you know, very clearly recognizable clinical conditions that would, you know, fit very neatly into the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual definitions of fear of heights or fear of public speaking or panic disorder. You look at the 2nd century AD, the ancient Roman physician Galen, same thing. So, you know, and then you, you know, flash forward all the way to the 19th century, and you had all kinds of people in Britain being diagnosed with, you know, hysteria, or in America with what there was an American physician named George Beard who developed the term neurasthenia and you know, claimed that Americans had an epidemic of neurasthenia, and all the way into the Freudian area where he sort of called neurotic anxiety either neurotic anxiety or, you know, neuroses. So this is a trait that is woven into the human condition, and, you know, some percentage of all humans across all of history have been disproportionately susceptible to responding hyperreactively to stress and, you know, developing what we now call anxiety disorders.
How clear is this in your memory from childhood? Can you talk a little bit and describe a little bit about your life, describe your life as a kid up to, you know, around the age of 10, I think your parents got you evaluated. Is this something somebody said to you when you were 11 or 12, you know, Scott, you're an anxious kid, you have anxiety disorder?
Yes, I mean, that's exactly what happened when I was around 10 or 11. And before that point, you know, I don't think I really, I couldn't have put a name on what plagued me. I mean, you mm-hmm. mentioned in the introduction that, you know, I had acute, what we call separation anxiety, which is a normal developmental stage for most kids. You know, starting with, you know, when they're 6 months old and they develop stranger anxiety, and then into early elementary school, you know, they're afraid to be separated from their parents. And I had that fairly acutely. But then as I got into 4th grade, 5th grade, 7th grade, high school even, and I still had it fairly severely, you know, that was a sign that maybe this was sort of an incipient anxiety disorder. So I remember as a kid, as you say, you know, being absolutely convinced that every time my parents were not at home, that they had died in a car accident, or that they had abandoned me, or that they were actually aliens. Now, again, you know, I talk to parents and I say, you know, just because your child has separation anxiety, most of the time that is a normal developmental stage. When it's unusually acute, or when it persists beyond the developmentally appropriate age, kind of into later elementary school, that's a sign that maybe the child, as I did, has more serious problems. And then I also, during this period, ages, you know, 6, 7, 8, developed a phobia called emetophobia, which to people who don't have it sounds awfully strange and idiosyncratic, but it's the pathological fear of vomiting. And for me, it sort of took over my life because I, you know, became a compulsive hand washer. I'd become terrified if anyone were ill. And so, you know, all through elementary school, you know, I knew that this kind of thing made me miserable. I didn't have a name for what ailed me. My mother had versions of the same thing, so I just sort of assumed this is the way life was. But, you know, fortunately, my parents took me to a psychiatric hospital when I was 10 to get evaluated, and then I was officially given these diagnoses, which sort of got me into psychotherapy and, you know, and went on from there. But despite, you know, getting this help at age 10, the ensuing years, you know, particularly age 12 and 13, were, you know, among the worst of my life, because my anxiety got a lot worse before it got a little bit better.
When you say a lot worse, Scott, I mean incapacitating, like not being able to leave the house on the weekend, go to school, run home from school, stay in your room, like what?
A little bit of all of the above. Mm. I actually managed, and in retrospect, it's sort of amazing to me that I did, to go to school. I mean, the worst year for me was seventh grade. I went to a new school. It was a private school, a very good school, but it was an all-boys school. And I think the transition combined with just sort of maybe adolescent transition was too much for me. And, you know, starting that fall, I just sort of had a kind of persistent, slow-rolling nervous breakdown that by the time I got to January, I remember when I came back from spring break, this would have been in January of 1982, you know, I remember coming home from school and just being, and all through that fall, my parents would literally physically have to force me into my clothes, walk me out to the car, you know, basically I'd get to school and the drama would be, you know, is my fear so bad that I literally can't get out of the car, or is my fear of humiliation and having my classmates see me, you know, getting forced out of the car by my parents worse? And, you know, I would get out of the car and sort of walk to the classroom feeling just full of dread and misery. And I got to January and, you know, it was literally, I can still remember rather vividly, you know, lying on the floor of the living room in our home. And just, you know, sort of screaming and frothing at the mouth and saying, you know, I'm so terrified, I can't take it. And that was the point at which, you know, my father called the psychiatrist I'd been seeing, and he got sort of emergency medications from the pharmacy. And those medications, even though they came with horrible side effects, it was Thorazine, which was an antipsychotic drug at the time known as a major sedative, and Valium, and then also some tricyclic antidepressants, managed to keep me in school. And in retrospect, it's amazing to me that I managed to stay in school despite the agony, because many times I would sort of have a panic attack in class and end up going to the nurse and beg to go home. And the first few times she would send me home, and after a while she started to learn, okay, he's just anxious, and she would very kindly walk around the school with me. And so I got through that year, and by eighth grade things were better, and I got through the rest of school with, you know, my anxiety was substantially reduced, although still, you know, an issue much of the time, but only intermittently and no longer so acute.
But you thought the medication helped you?
It did. I mean, I definitely think it was helpful and probably kept me in school when the alternatives were, you know, being housebound or institutionalized. But it didn't come without a cost. You know, I had been a, you know, reasonably talented athlete, had been a good soccer player, and before I went on medication. And once I went on the medication, you know, Thorazine has all kinds of sedating effects, and it, you know, sort of dehydrates you. And I became incredibly sluggish. And, you know, I remember going out, I was still on the Thorazine, going out for the soccer team in eighth grade. And all the coaches who'd been so impressed with me in seventh grade were thinking, what happened to this kid? Like, he can't, you know, he runs out of steam, he can't run fast anymore. And I had kind of a chronically dry mouth. So it was a little bit of a double-edged sword, but on balance, it kept me together enough to keep me in school, so it was worthwhile on balance. And then after, in eighth grade, I went off the Thorazine and have been off that medication ever since.
Did you have friends in middle school, junior high, high school?
Going in, I had a lot of friends. I mean, in fact, before the acute anxiety set in seventh grade, early that year before it set in, I actually was nominated to run for class president, and I didn't win, but I got votes, and so, you know, people, I was a normal seventh grade boy that you know, people liked. As the anxiety deepened and I sort of withdrew further and further into myself, it became almost too stressful to kind of engage in kind of conventional male banter. And so at lunchtime, you know, I would literally usually sit up by the teacher where I could just sort of quietly eat my meal. And so for a couple of years, I basically stopped socializing at all, seventh and eighth grade. And then coming out of that, as I started to get better, I once again developed some friendships. And so I had friends throughout the rest of high school. But there was a period there where I was unable to socialize practically at all.
You got some votes for student council president.
I did. Probably the geek and loser vote, but
still,
votes nonetheless.
You got some votes. Did you have to give a campaign speech?
I did, and actually it's funny you asked that, because this was before my public speaking anxiety. Well, I'd had issues with public speaking even before that. In sixth grade, I had a kind of freezing moment on stage during the school play. But I actually remember getting up and giving a speech and not being terribly anxious about it. And yet by the middle of that year, there were several occasions when in science class or English class, I would get up in front of the to stand in front of the classroom, and you know, my head would start to swim, and I would start to feel nauseous, and I'd sort of lose the ability to make words come out of my windpipe, and I would have to sort of squeak to the teacher, I don't feel well, I need to sit down, which was, of course, mortifying when you're 12 years old and people are cracking jokes. But I was, early that year, able to give a presidential speech that was maybe or not unwell received.
I want to ask you this before our first break, Scott. When did you meet someone else like you, actually diagnosed with anxiety disorder, and realize, hey, I'm not alone in this? Actually, there's a lot of people who have some of these problems coping, dealing with anxiety. When did you?
You know, it's funny. It's a good question. No one's ever asked it to me that way. And what's interesting is I don't think I first encountered other people like me on the pages of books when I got to college, and I obviously had a sort of vested interest in studying psychology and abnormal psychology, and I would read these case studies, and I thought, oh, well, this is me. You know, look at this. You know, I have panic disorder. I have generalized anxiety disorder. Here are these case studies. I didn't actually meet somebody. The irony is I'm sure I met many people who are like me, but most of those people, like me, you know, once I got past seventh grade, were very good at hiding their anxiety. And so, you know, just as I would not be confessing to them that I was feeling anxious, and they would not be confessing to me, and, you know, they were very good at projecting an aura of competence and confidence, and I was doing the same, I didn't know. So it actually, really, it's not until there are a few limited examples where people would talk to me about their anxiety, colleagues who I would have to help them through difficult times. Once the book came out, the floodgates opened, and I heard from all kinds of people, including many people that I had met years before and had worked with. And, you know, they would say, you know, I had no idea you were going through this. I was going through the same thing when we worked together 15 years ago, and I was ravaged by panic attacks. And I didn't know that about him, and he didn't know that about me. So,
thank you, Scott. We're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more. Scott Stossel is the editor of The Atlantic magazine. His national bestseller is My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. It's now out in paperback. So a short break on Midday. We'll come back and talk some more with Scott Stossel. If you care to join us during this conversation, we can take phone calls. Here's how to reach us. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. The Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. And we're on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. Welcome back to Midday, the Midday Show on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here, talking about anxiety disorders with Scott Stossel, editor of The Atlantic and author of My Age of Anxiety. Scott, you know, since the book came out in 2013, you said you've heard from many other people who've had to struggle with this disorder, learn to deal with it, come to terms with it. How do you feel these days, as a couple of years since the book originally came out? Do you feel less anxious now since you came out, so to speak, and people know about your anxiety? Is this talking about this on radio shows and been freeing for you in some way?
The short answer is yes, at least marginally so. You know, in the lead up to the book came out in hardcover just about a year ago, actually. And in the lead up to that, I was, you know, true to my style, you know, terrified that coming out with this, you know, I was not, you know, I was diagnosed, as we've been talking about, with anxiety disorders when I was 10 years old, and here I was at the time 44. I'd hit it for 34 years, and once I published the book, I couldn't put the genie back in the bottle, as it were. And the book came out, and the world didn't end, and that in itself was instructive because, you know, there's a certain amount of stigma that still attaches to anxiety and to mental illness, and a certain amount of shame that I had felt around it. And, you know, the fact that when the book came out and, you know, most people responded to it, you know, colleagues and friends, a lot of them with surprise, saying they had no idea that I had struggled with this. And then, as you say, you know, many, many people, friends, colleagues, strangers, some celebrities who are very public figures, coming to me and telling me that they have struggled with these or similar issues. And, you know, that, you know, simply the act of writing and finishing the book was therapeutic and consoling in a couple of different ways. I mean, one, just, you know, managing to persevere through the difficulty of writing a book and finishing it and having it be reasonably well received made me feel good. It was also, you know, through the research of the book and finding, you know, that all of these other people throughout all of history had suffered from anxiety, including some very, very famous, prominent, accomplished people, made me feel sort of less alone and gave me a sense of consolation. And then, you know, when the book came out and I had to do, you know, one of my, or several of my phobias are flying and public speaking. And, you know, in effect, the book tour was kind of protracted exposure therapy in that I had to take a bunch of flights and I had to give talks in front of sometimes large groups of people. And, you know, I would medicate for them. But I got, with time and with practice, you know, the number of days in advance for which I would feel, you know, acute, miserable dread diminished, and my confidence in my ability to, you know, do it without breaking down or falling apart also increased. But also, it was sort of, what was sort of liberating is that, you know, one of my fears before publishing the book was always that my anxiety, I'd have a breakdown on stage or something or on a radio show like this, and my anxiety would suddenly be revealed to the world, and it would be horribly embarrassing and kind of, you know, personally catastrophic. And yet now, having published the book, I've sort of preemptively announced that I'm anxious. And so I've always console myself, you know, before I walk on stage or onto a live television show, if I have to run off stage because I've suddenly been stricken by a panic attack, which I hope won't ever happen, at least I can always yell, just refer to chapter four, and, you know, they'll understand why.
The publication date of your book originally was January 7th, 2014, and I saw an essay from The Atlantic in 2013. So I don't worry too much about that. We just made a little correction on the air of something I said, but I wonder about you in journalism, being an editor. I was looking at your background here. You got to The Atlantic pretty much right out of Harvard in the early 90s and worked for a time at the American Prospect. And I've been back at The Atlantic for, 13 or 14 years or something like that. So I'm curious about anxiety and writing, anxiety and editing. You've done a lot of editing. Anxieties that you express or write about in the book is being so conscientious, you know, worried about making a mistake. And so I wonder if you thought about your anxiety and the career path you chose.
Yeah, I mean, people ask me that and say, you know, you're in a career that has lots of deadlines and there's a certain amount of stress, and you know, why would you gravitate to that? And it's a good question. And sometimes I wonder, well, you know, maybe I would have been better off as like a, you know, keeper of penguins at the aquarium or something. But the irony is, and yeah, I mean, but you know, the truth is, you know, these days, most, if not all, jobs are stressful. You know, we live in a kind of precarious, rapidly transforming economy. And, you know, one of the ironies is, I mean, yes, when I'm overwhelmed by stress, you know, for most of us, if you have enough stressful things kind of bearing down on you, you will be more likely to start developing anxious symptoms or the symptoms of an anxiety disorder. By the same token, in some ways, things that are like actually genuinely you have good reason to be stressful, I'm better at dealing with those than the kind of monsters in my own mind. And one of the ironies, again, when I published the extract from the book in The Atlantic late in 2013 before the book came out, you know, many people have talked about how I sort of actually have a calming presence, and that, you know, someone described me once as human Xanax. I can walk into a room and sort of calm people down, which is ironic because, you know, inside I may be churning. But the reality is when sometimes in genuinely stressful situations, I can kind of rise to the occasion. And that's true of many people who suffer from, you know, neurotic clinical anxiety. They worry about all kinds of things they don't need to worry about. But when the chips are down and there's a real crisis, they're actually better able to handle it. Not always, but sometimes.
So if you harness your anxiety in a way that you manage it, so to speak, that might actually improve performance?
Yeah, I mean, there are many ways that in which anxiety is an adaptive human trait. I mean, at base, the fear response and what you know is the kind of constituent physiological basis of a panic attack is basically the fight or flight response, which is an evolutionarily adaptive response that helped keep the species alive. You know, when you're in the middle of a fight or flight response, if you're confronted by something that is genuinely dangerous, like a saber-toothed tiger or an enemy tribe in the state of nature, you know, that physiological response with the blood flowing to your arms and legs, and you know, it enables you better to fight or to flee and to keep you alive. The problem with people who have anxiety disorders is that response gets triggered either sort of disproportionately to the stressor at hand, or triggered in response to nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it's not adaptive. But that said, there's a lot of studies that, you know, the right amount of anxiety is actually productive. You know, a little bit of the sort of physiological activation that comes with being anxious or apprehensive can make you perform better on a test because you get your adrenaline pumping. Or if you're stepping into the batter's box, you know, if you're overwhelmed with anxiety and consumed with, you know, the terror in your own mind, you're not likely to get a hit. But if you're anxious enough, you might do well. And actually, there was a couple of Harvard psychologists back about 100 years ago named Yerkes and Dodson came up with what they call the Yerkes-Dodson theory of anxiety. And they studied humans and other mammals. And basically, it's the Goldilocks theory of anxiety. And so if you picture kind of a graph and, you know, going from left to right, is degree of anxiety. And if you're way, way out on the right and you're severely, severely anxious, on the vertical axis is performance. So if you're way out on the and are so anxious that you can't focus and your body's melting down, you will have terrible performance. But on the other hand, if you have no anxiety and you just don't care, you're not going to give a good speech and you're not going to perform well on the test and you're not going to work hard at work. Where you want to be is kind of in the middle, just right, amount of anxiety, which is where the peak of the curve is, right, on the performance vertical axis. So there are many ways in which anxiety and the things associated with anxiety, as long as it's not too excessive, can actually help you in your career and in your life generally.
Scott Stossel is our guest. My Age of Anxiety, his book, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. What do you say to people who are skeptical and say, it sounds like you're just having you're just a worrier. You have problems coping with life. You know, there are people who take that attitude and wonder about, well, anxiety. Everybody feels anxiety, but I'm suspecting that part of your answer would be not to the point where it's incapacitating. Right? Is that where the line is drawn for you?
Right. It's not always easy to draw that line, and you know, the what they used to call the line between what they used to call the worried well, which is most of us, you know, we all deal with stress, and you know, the clinically anxious or the truly kind of anxiety disordered is not always so easy to draw. It's not like you have a broken leg, and you can look at an X-ray, and the X-ray will show you either have a broken leg or you do not. These days, you know, they're getting more and more sophisticated in doing, you know, functional magnetic resonance is an imaging, and you can actually see, you know, what parts of the brain are lighting up. So they know that, for instance, the amygdala, which is in the seat of the, you know, sort of at the base of the brain, is the seat of the fear response. You know, reacts more strongly and quickly in people who describe themselves as being more anxious. But that's not uniformly the case. You'll have some people who you show them fearful picture or scary pictures while they're in the fMRI machine, and their amygdala flares to the same degree that someone who has an anxiety disorder does. So you would think, okay, well, they must have an anxiety disorder. They're severely anxious. And you ask them, how anxious are you? And they say, well, not that anxious. Hmm. So it's very hard to draw the lines. I mean, what the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual does, which is that psychiatric, you know, sort of Bible of diagnoses, you know, they'll list a sets of symptoms and duration of those symptoms and that you have to have in order to be clinically officially diagnosed with a disorder. But those, you know, symptoms and durations are somewhat arbitrary. So, you know, who's to say that, you know, somebody who's suffering a lot from, you know, anxiety is not just worried a lot about work as opposed to being, you know, clinically anxious or having a medical disorder and being mentally ill. The bottom line is if your anxiety is causing you so much distress that you're just chronically unhappy and that it's inhibiting your ability to work or you're housebound or unable to maintain normal human relationships, you know, that is a disorder. And, you know, you should seek treatment of whatever kind because, you know, these anxiety disorders, even though they're very, very common, are also highly treatable compared to a lot of other diseases like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's millions of Americans, I don't know how many, are taking antidepressants millions of Americans. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, because your book is not memoir solely, it's got a lot of research in it too, the connection between anxiety and depression. Do those things to go hand in hand necessarily?
Yes, they are often, as the researchers say, the term of art is, you know, comorbid, which means, mm-hmm. you know, if you have depression or anxiety, you are much more likely than the average person to have also the other disease, which makes sense because, you know, a lot of the, you know, being depressed, you end up having some of the symptoms of anxiety, panic attacks and so forth. And being anxious because your life is so constraining or so constrained leads you to become depressed. But it does, again, and this gets into the squishiness of these diagnoses. You know, general, what's known as generalized anxiety disorder has been a diagnosis for 40 years officially in the American psychiatric establishment, and many people have been diagnosed with it, including myself, and there are treatments for it. But it's, you know, as researchers are starting to, it's so frequently co-occurring with depression, and the drugs that treat generalized anxiety disorder and that treat depression are so similar, and they're now starting to find, you know, similar genetic underpinnings. There's now an open question, it's kind of a running debate about, is generalized anxiety disorder actually distinct from depression, or is it really just a different manifestation of the same thing?
You know, over the last few days, I've been reading about ISIS and northern Iraq, and the people who live in the small cities and villages of northern Iraq, people dealing with, I mean, threats to their lives, threats of being kidnapped, or even being killed, you know, real fear of something that's immediate in their environment. And it got me thinking about anxiety. I mean, if anybody gets to be anxious, it would be people in those zones, or people who are hungry someplace. And I wonder why it's so prevalent in this society, leading to a larger question. I'm not saying that people don't have problems, but compared to other parts of the world, Scott, you know, things aren't so bad here.
No, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, there's a sort of theory that anxiety of the sort of neurotic variety is a luxury of, you know, prosperity and you know, peaceful setting. And, you know, the distinction that, say, Freud would make, you know, he talked about between neurotic anxiety, or made a distinction between neurotic anxiety and real anxiety, or between neurotic anxiety and fear. And what people in Syria or Iraq confronting, you know, the imminent reality of violence and death, that is legitimate fear. And, you know, there's nothing neurotic about that. That is totally warranted. And, you know, it can lead to later on one of the anxiety disorders, which is post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, because, you know, kind of chronic exposure to trauma or even limited exposure to trauma can do permanent damage to the brain, so that later in life, even once they're out of danger, they may find themselves with a kind of dysfunctional brain that is responding fearfully to non-fearful things. But there is something to the idea that, you know, it's in some ways the prosperity and freedom of the West, Western civilization, that actually gives us the luxury of being anxious. And, you know, in my research, I looked back, you know, all the way back to, you know, the 4th century BC, but looked at various ages. And around the mid-century of this year, there were a lot of sociologists and psychologists who were looking at the Middle Ages compared to what they were then calling kind of the Age of Anxiety, because it was the Atomic Age. And, you know, their point was that in the Middle Ages, if you were born then, your life was materially much, much worse than it was if you were born in 1950s America. You're likely to die earlier. You're likely to get some horrible disease or be killed a violent death. You know, your quality of life was just lower. And yet you probably weren't suffering from a lot of neurotic anxiety because you had no choice. You know, you were born into the role you were going to inhabit. You figured you were probably doomed to eternal damnation as part of the kind of Christian cosmology of the time, versus in modern life where you're born and you have all these choices, from the trivial, like which of 57 kinds of cereal do I pick out at the supermarket, to do I want to be a lawyer or a doctor, or should I marry this person or that person, or do I want to be a stay-at-home mom? And this gives you the possibility for regret. And again, you know, all these advances in liberty and economic material well-being are net positives, but they do lead to an increase in anxiety, especially when combined with uncertainty of the modern economy and the rapid pace of social transformation and uncertainty about social roles and all those kinds of things.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here. My guest, Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic magazine. The paperback edition of his national bestseller is out, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. More with Scott when we get back. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Our guest, Scott Stossel's book is about anxiety, living with it, struggling with it, coming to terms with it, My Age of Anxiety. An email from Maya, one of our listeners, Scott, says, anxiety is real. My son is now 20. He has suffered with all kinds of anxieties, separation, lots of fears, stayed in his room all of high school. Now he is at Amherst College, interned in D.C. last summer. He just said to me, Mom, I will not let my anxieties define who I am. He's my hero.
That's a wonderful story, and it shows that, you know, one can go from being confined to one's room to going to an exceptional college to professional success. And it also shows that, you know, clearly, even if he was confined to his room, he must have been working very, very hard and getting good grades in order to get into a college like Amherst. So again, you know, anxiety is not you may have to live with it for your whole life, but it's not a terminal diagnosis in the way that some psychiatric disorders are. And you can overcome it, and you can harness it, and you can come to terms with it in positive ways. And it sounds like this listener's son did that. So I applaud that.
Julie writes in, curious about your relationship with your wife, how your wife handles your panic attacks or learn to deal with them, especially if and when they become debilitating.
It's funny, when the book came out in hardcover last year, one of my colleagues who had known nothing about my anxiety disorder but had read the book and sort of been stunned by the degree to which you know, it can be debilitating and the sort of sometimes embarrassing situations it had put me in, went up to my wife and said, what do you get out of this? This seems like an awful handful to manage. And my wife said, well, sometimes he's kind of funny. you know, I will say in my defense that, first of all, you know, I'm incredibly grateful and lucky that I have. Now, my wife, you know, she suffers, again, the sort of normal amount of anxiety. She will get nervous before public speaking or what have you, but doesn't really have any experience at all with clinical anxiety, which is very good for me and for our kids. But, you know, very early in our relationship when we were first dating, I had actually, you know, been fairly candid, as I'm not, had not been with most people, and told her about my disorders. But again, you know, she hadn't seen evidence of it, so it was kind of an abstraction. And then we planned a trip to London, which I thought would be a nice romantic getaway. But of course, this requires a transatlantic flight. And we get on the plane, and, you know, go into full, you know, panicky meltdown. And I can see her sort of looking at me and kind of horror and bewilderment. And the fact that she stayed with me after that, you know, on the one hand, I can say, she knew what she was getting into. But I'm enormously grateful that she, you know, saw that and yet didn't run for the hills.
Before we go to our phone lines to take calls for Scott, you referred to self-medicating before, and I know you've written about this. I was curious about where you are with that today. Like, if you're going to take a flight, if you're going to go speak, do some public speaking somewhere, how do you prepare for that in terms of what you ingest?
I get that question a lot. It depends on a lot of things having to do with the what I perceive to be the stakes of the event, mm-hmm. my state of mind. But I've gotten better at titrating the dosages and trying to limit them. And, you know, I still do before most, if I'm going to go in front of a bunch of people, you know, if I don't take enough medication of various kinds, you know, there is a danger that I will get so overwhelmed by anxiety, just sort of physical anxiety, that I will not be able to speak, or that I'll get overwhelmed with panic and have to run off. If I get the right amount, I'm fine, and I'll seem completely calm and cool and reasonable. So I would like to get to the point. My goal for the coming years is to reduce by degrees the amount of medication. You know, mostly benzodiazepines like Xanax and Klonopin, which are, you know, for me highly effective and for many people highly effective, but also have all kinds of dangerous side effects and dependency and withdrawal risks, and in sort of resort to a medication of sorts that no doctor would recommend, you know, in dire straits, I will sometimes resort to supplementing the benzodiazepines with alcohol, which is in the short term incredibly effective chemically at reducing anxiety. In the long term is a very, very dangerous thing, and any doctor recommending that would be should have their license revoked. So I do not endorse or recommend that.
And you're working toward less of all of it.
Yes. My goal, which I don't know if I'll ever achieve, would be to be completely medication-free and to be able to kind of live in the world and go through, you know, flying or riding on a chairlift or appearing in front of a live studio audience without any medication whatsoever. And, you know, my current psychotherapist, Dr. W, as I call him in the book, continues to believe that he can get me to that point. I'm a little bit skeptical, but I'm hopeful.
Let's take a couple of calls for Scott Stossel. Scott, this is Dan in Federal Hill on the south side of Baltimore. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
First, I'd like to just acknowledge Scott. I think it's very courageous what you've done just to talk about this in such a, you know, big way. That's, you know, kudos to you. That's very big. I've had anxiety since I was younger. One of the things was public speaking. And I learned how to manage it without medication, just by meditation or acupuncture or yoga. But what I did notice, I traveled a lot. That helped with it too. But I lived in the island of Tonga for about 3 years, and I was just so amazed how everyone was so free of anxiety. Like on a social level, it just didn't exist. It's just, the environment, sure. But something else is going on. You said something about material. We have so much material comforts, I think, that could be causing some of the anxiety, not a lot of it. But in that place where there wasn't anything around them, materially speaking, other than the beauty of nature, which is also very calming, they were just free of anxiety and stress and depression. And I'm just wondering how many studies you've looked at that looks at indigenous groups or peoples who live, you know, relatively free of material, you know, accoutrements.
Mm-hmm.
And just I'll take it.
They have less stuff than we do. Does that make them less anxious?
It could well. And it's fascinating to me to look at, and first of all, I want to thank the caller Dan for his kind words, and also to say that the things that he uses to alleviate his anxiety, mindfulness meditation, you know, that's a sort of derived from Eastern philosophy and medicine. There's all kinds of now, Western evidence-based stuff supporting that is highly, highly effective at reducing anxiety, and yoga, the same thing. But back to the kind of cross-cultural comparisons, it's fascinating to me that certain cultures are just much higher in anxiety than others. And it is true that in the developed world, there are higher rates of anxiety than in sometimes lesser developed ones. And is that, again, get back to the thing of there's the luxury of having the time to worry about it? Or is it that, you know, there are in more tightly knit communities, there's less sort of status anxiety and status competition? And, you know, there's fascinating studies. This is not about anxiety per se, but if you compare, for instance, this is just one study, Nigeria and the United States. In Nigeria, rates of diagnosis of schizophrenia are incredibly low relative to the average rate of diagnosis of schizophrenia in the United States. When Nigerians emigrate to the United States, they end up with higher, on average, levels of schizophrenia than the typical American. So what does that mean? Is there something about Nigerian culture that is, you know, provides resistance to schizophrenia and America causes schizophrenia? Or is it that, moving to America and being part of a minority group, that causes stress that leads to schizophrenia? So there are fascinating questions about the way that kind of culture and biology and psychology interact. And I do think, you know, I'm no opponent of capitalism, but I do think that the kind of, you know, everyone for himself competition of late industrial capitalism, it creates a lot of good things, but also a lot of anxiety in a way that, the folks that Dan encountered on the island might not have been exposed to.
Here's Meg in Baltimore for Scott Stossel. Go right ahead, Meg.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having the show today. I just wanted to say that as someone with panic disorder and having gone through a lot of behavioral therapy about how to cope in a situation where I feel panic, in some ways I feel like I'm better equipped than most people to interact in situations that cause panic. So, for example, you know, I might be in the grocery store line and the fluorescent lights and the kind of being in a line situation give me a lot of anxiety and might cause me to start to panic. The same skills that I employ there to, you know, get control of myself and do what needs to be done are the same skills that I use to teach at a Baltimore City Detention Center class, which also has fluorescent lights and sort of an element of you're not allowed to get out.
Right.
So.
It's interesting. That's very interesting, Meg. So you think that's helped you. I can see that.
Well, no,
I think it's helped me a lot, and I think it's also given me the courage to do things that I'm afraid otherwise to do.
Let's hear from Scott.
Two observations about that, Meg. One is fluorescent lights, classic stimulant, classic cause of panic attacks. There's something about the flickering of the lights that makes many people, including me, start to feel that the room is swimming and you're suddenly in the throes of a panic attack. So I'm well familiar with that, as are any other listeners who suffer, or many other listeners who suffer from panic. But to the second point, one of most interesting studies that I came across in my research was a study of neurotic and anxious people in England, in London, during the Blitz of London in World War II, when they were getting bombs dropped on them all the time. And this study was fascinating to me because what it showed was these are people who are all in therapy and had been diagnosed with various neuroses and anxieties. Their anxiety actually diminished during the bombing. And partly this was because they didn't feel like they had to hide their fear. You know, everyone was running around scared because nobody wants to get a bomb dropped on their head. And this relieved the pressure of having to hide their fearfulness. But the second part of it was, and this is slightly speculative, but it's what Meg was saying, is that, you know, they've been trained 3 years of being afraid of things they don't need to be afraid of, to when they're, you know, feeling that same feeling when there are bombs raining down on them, they're actually, you know, maybe better equipped to handle it than people who haven't been worrying and in terror much of their lives. So I think there's really something to that.
Hey, Scott, we're about at the end of our hour. I'm sad to say it's been a really good hour with you. I'm curious about just generally how you're doing these days, and how are you and Cheese getting along these days?
Cheese and I still have a very unfriendly relationship. That's one of my more unusual phobias, and it's somewhere between a phobia and an acute aversion that I think has something to do with, there's a story from my family lore where my sister ate a piece of cheese off the floor of the airport, and my mother, who had the fear of vomiting, yelled at her, and then my sister got sick, and I think that somehow linked the two in my mind. Overall, you know, it's still, I'm not cured. You know, I'm always very gratified when I hear from people who read the book and say that it made them feel less anxious and better. And I think it's somewhat ironic because I feel like it made other people feel less anxious, you know, reduce other people's anxiety than it did my own. But it did help a little bit, and I'm still, I feel sort of energized by the number of people who have come to me who themselves formerly suffer from anxiety and have gotten better through, you know, a bazillion different ways. And so, I'm continuing to try to take two steps forward, one step back towards, you know, peace and serenity and remission from anxiety.
Scott, it's been a pleasure to have you on our show here in Baltimore and WYPR. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, too. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic Magazine, an author of this book that's been in hardcover for better part of a year now, called My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. My Age of Anxiety is now available from Vintage and paperback. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Thanks to those who contributed to it. Please come back again for another edition of Midday, 22 hours from now, noon to 2 each day, each weekday here on WYPR. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at wypr.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.